WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
With me now on Fresh Air is writer Dave Marsh. He's the author of Born to Run, a biography that covers the early career of rock star Bruce Springsteen. It became the top-selling rock bio in publishing history. Marsh's new book, Glory Days, examines Springsteen's career since 1980. Marsh sees Springsteen's music as representing the triumph of conviction over trendiness. Here's the song that made Springsteen famous, performed in the 1985 world tour that made him into a megastar. Born to Run from Springsteen's album Live, 1975 to 85. Since 1974, my guest Dave Marsh has both followed Springsteen's career and contributed to it. It was he who first took Rolling Stone critic John Landau to see Springsteen play in a Boston bar. Landau later became Springsteen's manager, and Marsh has remained a close friend of Springsteen's. Marsh is also the editor of the Rolling Stone Record Guide. He now publishes a monthly newsletter titled Rock and Roll Confidential that examines the political, social, and economic implications of popular music. Dave Marsh, welcome to Fresh Air.
Nice to be here.
You seem to see Springsteen not only as a great performer, but as almost a savior of rock music. What do you think rock music needs to be saved from?
Well, you know, one of the things I try to do in this new book is, Glory Days, is back off a little bit from the idea of the messianic part of savior. And just to get into the idea that what we're all trying to do is bail ourselves out of the deepest crises of our lives. Rock and roll gets trapped in a bunch of trash, in being a vehicle just for selling beer or something. What I think Bruce tried to do was save himself from that anguish of having his best ideas and thoughts converted into songs that were then converted into beer commercials. And what I think rock and roll needs is more of that kind of conversion, it needs conversion in that sense. And for myself, I guess the fear has always been, what would you do without it, and what are you going to do with it?
It's a
double-edged sword. Because to me, it was like my culture.
Well, let me quote something that you. I'm going to quote something that you say in your first book. You wrote, "Rock saved my life; it also broke my heart."
Well, it seemed like a pure thing to me, and I guess I was naive, but it did seem like a pure thing to me. It seemed like there were these singers that got in the studio, they sang these songs, and they spoke from the bottom of their heart. And I'm thinking about songs like, I guess the great example for right now, because it was a hit again last year, is that Benny King song, "Stand By Me."
Yeah.
You know, when the night is dark, and just. That whole idea of, like, when you're most alone, something that will come and stand by your side and not let you down. For Bruce, it was a song like Roy Orbison's "Only the Lonely Know the Way I Feel Tonight." And I think Bruce Springsteen is a person who writes those songs. But at a certain point, rock and roll did break my heart because it became clear that it was a business. And it was a business in the most kind of cynical way. Now, like I said, that's my fault as much as it's fault. And I guess the best way to protect yourself and save yourself from that is to grow up and adopt a more mature attitude about it. But until Born in the USA, I really don't think that any pop star had done a very complete job of that. John Lennon tried and came close. Elvis failed miserably, and Elvis was everybody's icon. Mick Jagger just got old and cynical. Bob Dylan kind of walked a neat path and then got lost on it. Bruce Springsteen made it to the highest heights that I think any serious rock performer has made, and at the very moment of his greatest success, reached down and touched a community that he was supposed to be completely isolated from. And one of the great things when we were doing the last interview we did for the book was in January. One of the great things was he explained all this to me, not in terms of what he was able to do for other people, but what that connection had done to rescue him from the fate of isolation that somebody like Elvis had to experience.
Yeah, he's very aware of the traps that megastars fall into, and you make a lot of comparisons between him and Elvis, and fame more or less killed Elvis Presley.
I think it did, you know, not only because, I mean, there are people who make an argument that may have some legitimacy that Elvis's over-medication was the result of him being quite sick. But if that was the case, then somebody wasn't communicating very well with somebody else about what his physical condition was. So one way or the other, the isolation, the being placed on a pedestal, is what made him no longer alive at 43. And that's I don't know if people out who aren't big rock and roll fans really would understand what a tragedy that is, what it means for a sharecropper's son from Tupelo, Mississippi, to have reached into so many lives. And maybe somebody who's not a rock fan doesn't believe. Well, I know that from the cut of my hair to the mere fact that I can stand in front of a microphone and speak, I owe Elvis Presley. I owed him. And I know that Bruce Springsteen feels that. And I know that there are enormous numbers of people who feel that. And that somehow behind all that, there was a bigger idea blossoming than just the pink Cadillac that he sang about.
Even though Springsteen has been aware of the price of fame, didn't hype and publicity almost kill his career in the beginning?
Twice.
I remember, yeah, 1975, there were the simultaneous covers of Time and Newsweek.
In 1972, when he made his first record, and he'd been discovered by John Hammond, who discovered everybody from Bessie Smith to Aretha Franklin, Bob Dylan, Billie Holiday, Benny Goodman, and John Hammond had discovered Bob Dylan. And so they promoted Springsteen as the new Dylan. Now, there have been 50 people, I bet you, hyped as the new Dylan since the old Dylan became successful. I should say the real Dylan became successful. Bruce Springsteen is the only person whose career survived it. And then in 1975, he made the album Born to Run. And that is a classic rock and roll riff. It's a classic rock and roll song, from the lyric, the music, the whole business. On the other hand, that doesn't necessarily mean that it was going to be a mega-selling record. It was not trendy in any way. And when that hype didn't work, a lot of people figured he was finished again. And one of the things that my first book, Born to Run, was about was how does someone solve this problem and why didn't he fade away and disappear? Which, an answer that's steeped more in the qualitative than the quantitative. In fact, his next album sold measurably less than Born to Run hit, Darkness on the Edge of Town. And the album after that, it was called The River, sold only a little more than Born to Run. But what was really going on then was that Bruce had forced the marketing mechanisms of his record company to pull back. And because he was afraid of another bout of this overexposure, which probably would have killed him. And it wound up with him being the most idolized rock star with a big concert audience and not so much awareness outside of the narrow world of the rock concert cult.
Dave Marsh is my guest. He's a rock critic who is the author of the new book, Glory Days, Bruce Springsteen in the 80s. Now, Springsteen really made his reputation with teenage anthems about frustration, sexual frustration, frustration about wanting to get out of the town you were born into. And then as he got older...
I think it's class rage is another way to look at it.
Sure, yeah. And as he got older, those lyrics didn't seem quite as relevant. I mean, because he didn't need the sexual frustration. He wasn't a teenager anymore.
He told me an interesting thing. He said that the Born to Run album, which is encapsulated for me in one line at the end of the song Thunder Road, was the first song on the record he sings. This is a town full of losers, and I'm pulling out of here to win. He said, well, that was my story. The Born to Run album was his story, personally. And he said, after that was over, he looked around and he said, well, what about everybody else? And at that point, the teenage anthems stop. And the work begins to mature. The vision begins to darken and deepen. And you begin to get a broader spectrum of humanity. Still with some of those teenage reference points, there's still a lot of cars and a lot of women referred to as girls. Until you get to, but the answer is still, you know, he's still got this inadequate answer, because the inadequate answer is to hold your guitar up in the air and hit it real hard and make a loud and joyful noise. When he made the River album, which sold 2 million copies, which is a very, very large number of records, what they call double platinum, and he did an enormously successful concert tour, and for the first time he played Europe and in a really large scale and was real successful there. And he came back and he toured the United States again, and he was a huge act. And he was surrounded by adulation, and he had a crew who are really, the people who work with him are the most skillful technicians in rock and roll. Not necessarily the best paid, although they make they make a lot of money, but there's a team spirit there. There's a band that's one of the better bands in rock and that has a real familial feeling. When that tour was over, he went home. He wasn't married. He had a girlfriend. He broke up with her. He lived in a rented house, and he was alone. And through all of that, he had not found the thing he was looking for, because he was not, you know, rock and roll is always presented as this rebellion, question of rebellion. And in fact, that's only it only could be half the story, because every rebel is looking for to reconcile himself and join a community and find a better society to build. And I believe that when Bruce Springsteen sat down in his bedroom in 1982 and to make a little cassette demo of songs for his next album, which wound up being the album Nebraska, that he was feeling just at the bottom of a pit of utter desolation and fear, and that the fear and desolation is exactly what we were talking about with Elvis Presley, that he had been cast out, and he had missed his mark. And here was the most successful guy, and he was alone. And not alone, being alone is a good thing. You know, any writer has to like to be alone. But being lonely is an awful thing. I can't think of anything worse. Certainly, the Nebraska album was often interpreted, and I think correctly, as a response to the Reagan years, when men and women were turned against one another in vicious and cruel ways, that the competition became a really, really sick thing. But it was also the product of this personal, I think, failure.
Well, I want to play an excerpt of one of the songs from Nebraska. And you were talking about how at some point he realized he didn't just have to keep retelling his own story from a teenage perspective. He could start telling other people's stories, too, in lyrics. And I think that's part of what he was
doing
on this record.
Right. And this is a song about a man at the end of his tether who is and isn't the guy who's singing it.
This is State Trooper from the Nebraska album by Bruce Springsteen, and this was recorded, what, just in his basement?
In his bedroom.
His bedroom.
And in fact, I'm not sure if this is one of the songs, but if you listen, you may hear the chair creaking as he rocks out, because he's just sitting with an acoustic guitar in a chair.
Let's give it a listen. This is Bruce Springsteen from the Nebraska album.
New Jersey Turnpike. I don't know where now. Neath the refineries glow, out where the great black rivers flow. License registration, I ain't got none, but I got a clear conscience about the things that I. Mr. State Trooper, please don't stop me. Please don't stop me. Please don't stop me.
That's an excerpt of State Trooper from the Bruce Springsteen Nebraska album. And my guest is Dave Marsh, the author of a new biography of Springsteen called Glory Days. I really love the sound of that. There's something very kind of scary and on the
spooky
edge about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting that they released the album like it was. I mean, he'd considered doing it with a band,
right? Well, they just had
this
little cassette, and they tried to do it with a band. And what happened was that Bruce just felt it lost the atmosphere.
And it did. And I think one of the reasons it lost the atmosphere is if you're playing with a band, you don't have that feeling of stark isolation that's in that music. And what that music's about is not the chords, which are pretty simple and basic.
Was there any kind of turning point for him after the album was released? It's not one of his best-selling records, but it's a really personal statement.
Well, what had happened was they recorded almost all of the Born in the USA album at the same time, and he insisted on releasing this record. And then he and a friend of his, Matty D'Elia, who owns a motorcycle shop in North Jersey, drove to California. Got to California. Bruce got out of the car, went into the house he had out there, and couldn't even sit down. Really, I need to go home. He wanted to drive straight back, which is not what he did. He sat down and tried to figure out why he felt so wretched. And out of that began to come some songs that were about a little bit different group of things. First song that came up was a song, My Hometown.
I want to talk about the Born in the USA album and play a couple of things from it, but we're going to take a short break first.
Sure.
My guest is Dave Marsh, and we're talking about the subject of his new book, Glory Days. It's about Bruce Springsteen in the 1980s. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and my guest is Dave Marsh. He's the author of Glory Days, which is a companion to his earlier biography of rock star Bruce Springsteen. The first book was called Born to Run. We were just talking about Born in the USA, which that's his biggest seller, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. That sold 18 million copies worldwide, 12 million in the United States, had 7 top 10 singles, all that stuff. You know, it's like roughly speaking, by a single artist, it's probably the biggest album ever made by a single artist, except for Thriller by Michael Jackson, of course.
You tell a story in your book about how most of the songs were written and already recorded.
Right. Well, they did 70 songs.
Yeah, that's right.
They selected the 10 for the Nebraska album, and then they selected 11 for the Born in the USA album, which was called Born in the USA because that song just asserted itself as the theme of the album immediately, which those of you who've heard it will understand immediately. But and the way that they did that was they wanted songs that fit together and told people Bruce's vision of the world in this period. John Landau, his manager, and he had a discussion while they were mixing the record, which is just placing the songs in the right sounds and the right perspective. And John said, well, you know, Bruce, he said, I don't think we're done. I think we need one more song. And he said, it ought to be a single. It ought to be our first single. And what it ought to do is it ought to tell people where you're at right now. And Bruce, this was pretty strong words coming from a manager-producer. And Bruce responded equally strongly by saying that since he had written 70 songs, maybe John Landau would like to try writing one. John said, well, you know, I can't do that, but I think I got a right to speak my mind. And this is very indicative of the creative process when these guys make a record. Not the way everybody else does, but when these guys do, there's this argument that goes on. And as Bruce said, when it works, nobody wins and nobody loses. Just the truth comes out. Well, they went into the studio and mixed that evening, and without rancor, the argument was over. And Bruce went back to his hotel room where he was staying cooped up, feeling fairly miserable and locked up. Picked up his guitar and began to sing a song that he had been thinking about, a little melody he'd been thinking about, and some words he had kind of prepared, and he put them together for the first time, and he sang, I get up in the morning. And he thought to himself, well, I don't get up in the morning. What do I do? He said, well, I get up in the evening, and how do I feel about this? Well, just tired and bored with myself. And then he kind of got through the first verse of the song. And he said, then it was as though his heart spoke through his mouth without passing through his brain. And he sang the chorus of the song, which is, this gun's for hire, even if we're just dancing in the dark, which is about just itching for action, which is actually another line in the song. And basically came out with a song that when you hear it, there's a certain exuberance and joy to it. But if you really listen to the lyrics of this song, and it's the biggest hit single he ever had, he gave John Landau exactly what he wanted. But he also gave him not what he was feeling in this period of time, but at that moment, I want out of this. But also, the only way out of it is to go deeper in. And came up with what, for me, is, with the exception of the track Born in the USA, I guess the most exciting piece of music he'd ever done. Out of sheer frustration and anger and confusion and dire necessity.
It's a great record. Why don't we hear something?
I think it is, yeah.
This is Dancing in the Dark.
And I ain't got nothing to say.
Bruce Springsteen singing Dancing in the Dark. There's a great line that I don't think we got to yet, that I want to change my clothes, my hair, my face.
Well, that, you know, one of the things I love about that line is that it harks back to how you felt when you were 16. When you're 16...
You don't give up feeling that way when you get older.
Well, exactly. But I mean, when that is the definition of how you feel when you're an adolescent. And at the same time, I bet you, Bruce is 37 now, so am I. And I bet you there are a lot of people in all the ages in between listening to the show who know exactly what we mean. You know, I mean, I got up this morning and I'm on a book tour, so I'm groggy and I didn't even shave. And, you know, I mean, my turn when I get back to the hotel, you know. It won't work, but you got to keep trying. But what you can change is maybe you can help change the face of the world.
You know, I have to tell you, I felt betrayed by his rock video of that song, which was directed by Brian De Palma.
A lot of us did.
He's, for our listeners who haven't seen it, he's singing this song about frustration, looking really happy and healthy and smiling, and he dances with an actress who's planted in the audience.
Don't blame Brian De Palma. Some pains in the book about this, because I like Brian. I think he's talented, even though he cuts his own throat a lot. This was not his fault. The thing is that Bruce wrote this song out of a feeling of terrible isolation, and what you hear when you hear that record is the joy of the music followed by its negation in the lyrics and the vocal of just anguish. And what he did when he sang it in the video was he smiled all the way through, and he had just had his teeth fixed, so the smile was looked like ultra Brill Cream. Ultra bright, and that was the mistake was that he contradicted the emotion of the song in his performance. But on the other hand, you know, again, you don't feel the same way when you're singing this song and there are 20,000 people who love you in the room.
To me, though, it's just the inherent problem of rock videos, that the mood of the video frequently has nothing to do with the mood you feel when you hear the record. And then it's inalterably changed for you because you see the video going by instead of this mood you had in your mind.
I find myself ignoring video more and more,
right, okay,
and having this problem less and less.
When the album that's from came out, Born in the USA, everyone seemed to want to appropriate it for their needs. Like, people on the left said, okay, this is a really strong anti-war statement that Bruce is making.
Well, the song Born in the USA is what we're talking about, and that's a song about a Vietnam veteran who gets sent over to Vietnam. I don't know if people know that this happened a lot. It happened to a lot of kids in my hometown where you'd get busted for car theft or something, and they said, well, you can go to jail or you can go in the service.
And
then he comes home and he gets trashed. You know, he has no job and he has nothing, just like a Vietnam veteran.
No, a lot of people interpreted
George
this,
Will
though,
tried to
a...
expropriate it. Mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan tried to expropriate it. Walter Mondale did, in a different way Bill Bradley did. So Bruce was really shot by both sides.
How did he react to that?
Well, he reacted. Bruce is, you know, there's a Reaganite quality to Bruce in a funny way in terms of him as a media manipulator. He has a great way of turning every negative into a positive. And he insists on making affirmative statements. What he didn't do, which I think was smart, was go head-to-head with Reagan and become just another rock star screaming at the president. What he did instead was say to himself, I believe, something along these lines. I have been asked by both Mondale and Reagan to make a choice, to choose a side. Whose side am I on? And he was smart enough to say, well, I am on the side not of the Democrats or the Republicans. I'm on the side of a third party composed of the homeless, the hungry, the unemployed, the dispossessed, the Vietnam veteran. And what he did was, in all of his shows after Reagan's speech, because Reagan's speech was the key thing, because obviously he would be closer somehow to Mondale than to Reagan, by as much as Mondale differed from Reagan, which isn't much. And in every show after that, when he went into the town, he had one of the people who worked on his staff, who happens to be my wife, Barbara Carr, go in or call ahead, find community groups. Often people worked with hungry or unemployed people or homeless people. Those were the three areas, the most common. But he did some citizens' rights kind of groups. And he would meet, Barbara gathered literature. He would meet with these people for half an hour right before the show, go on, do the first hour of his show, then sing the song My Hometown, prefaced by an introduction in which he talked about, in your hometown, this is going on, these are the people. And that was a way of affirming what he was for rather than attacking what he was against. And to me, it was strategically, number one, it was a brilliant piece of media manipulation. And number two, it answered the question on everybody's lips. Well, what does he think about this Reagan thing without getting him into some silly contretemps with the president, which you can't win?
Yeah. You know, a couple of things I want to ask you, but I wonder if you think he's at another crisis now. We're running short on time, so I guess I'll have to get to get this quickly.
Well, I don't think he is. I think he's like Walter Payton when you're just a couple steps past the secondary. They might turn around and trip him up, but I bet they don't.
But here's the thing. I mean, he's still like very New Jersey, right? Doesn't he still have a house in New Jersey? But you know, his wife is
they split their time
California actress and model.
No, she's from Oregon, but you know what? She loves New Jersey. Uh-huh. This is very important because the answer to the worry that I hear in your voice and see in your face, and I hear out there all the time when I'm talking about this, is, you know, they're going to build a life for themselves, and somehow they're going to write and create things about it. And you know what I think? I think we're going to like a lot of it, and we're not going to like some of it. But somehow the dialogue between Bruce Springsteen and his audience, which is his first true love, is going to go on. And I think he got over. He's a grown-up making music now, and there's never been one of those before in rock and roll. And so I'm along for the ride.
Well, that leads me to one more thing, which is that you've been grown up for a lot of years now. Does rock and roll still mean the same thing to you now that you have, you know, kids about to go to college?
Listen to my voice when I talk about that. I got a kid who's going to go to college in the fall who loves you too, and if she probably had her druthers, would spend the summer following him around, and I will discourage her from doing that. But I sure am sorry to be on a book tour and miss going and seeing her smiling face when she comes home from the show or going with her. But, yeah, it still means the same thing to me. And you know, I can go – now I got 30 years to go back and – look at, and I got 30 years to look forward to, and that's a nice thing.
One last thing. You're good friends with Bruce Springsteen. Does he swear you to secrecy about his private life on these tours? Because I know he's very private.
I feel like I'm walking a thin line all the time, not because he swears me to secrecy, but because I really would like to honor his privacy, which he needs and earns by being such a great guy in public.
Dave Marsh, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Rock critic Dave Marsh is the author of the new book, Glory Days, Bruce Springsteen in the 1980s. This is Fresh Air.